Hello and welcome to Chats, a television podcast, Season 7, Prisoner Chats. My name is Magellan, and I'm joined by an old chap whose file I simply must bring up to date. Let's see here. Ah, yes. File number 6, section 42, subsection 6, paragraph 3. Add sense of humor, strong and unimpaired. Also, very handsome. It's Alan.
Oh. Hello, everybody. It's me, Alan.
How you doing?
I'm here. I'm excited. It's a new chat season. I'm fresh-faced, young, and I'm trapped inside. Just like we're doing a prisoner role play, man. We're
we're
trying to emulate it.
Yep. This is a well, okay, there's a lot to explain. So
you may have a couple questions.
Yeah, let me put a pin in that for a second. So if you are a returning listener from a previous chat season, perhaps you've just watched Babylon 5 with us. Welcome back after that brief hiatus. We're glad that you're still with us, and we hope that you enjoy this lovely romp through this situation we're about to find ourselves in. If you are a brand new listener to Chats, a Television Podcast, here's how it works. Again, my name is Alan. Nope. That was
wow.
A genuine mistake. That was a genuine mistake.
You're
that
kidding.
Was not a that was not a bit.
That's how good of friends we are, is that you often will forget which one is you.
Wow.
That's incredible. Wow. Keep it, though. That's legendary.
My name is Magellan. I'm joined by my best friend, Alan.
Hi.
And by the way, my pronouns are he, him. Alan, what are yours?
My pronouns are he and they.
Okay, great. So we've been best friends since high school, and together we pick cult classic TV shows and we watch through them in their entirety 2 episodes a week. So we've covered a few shows. You heard me say that this is season 7. Season 1 was Farscape, Scape Chats. Season 2, we covered Freaks and Geeks. Then we did Avatar The Last Airbender. Then we took a look at, I pretended like I was going to know this. It's The Newsroom. I do know it. Thank you. Season 5 was Pushing Daisies, Daisy Chats. And season 6 was our coverage of Babylon 5, known as Chatsalon 5, which we, Babylon 5 and its spinoff Crusade. And now we're here covering The Prisoner together. So, yeah, we're going to do this for 2 episodes a week for the next, I think that puts us at, I can actually answer that without having to guess. That's 10 more weeks or so, 10 weeks total of Prisoner coverage before we start a different show. So this is a nice little mini season for us here.
That would also include us probably checking out the 2009 remake at some point.
Yeah, that's built in. But as of right now, we're just watching the original 67 to 68 series.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. You know what, John? I actually watched the trailer for the 2009 miniseries before we hit record. Yeah, I did watch it.
What was? Did it seem good?
No.
Okay. All right.
It's like really actiony and really there's like he runs away from an explosion at one point.
Oh no.
No,
the number
no.
2 in episode 2 kind of looks like a knockoff Ian McKellen a little bit.
Yes, and then Ian McKellen just straight up is number 2 in the remake, so it works out.
Right, exactly. Okay, great. So let's see. So you were now the historical context piece that you were saying, a complete accident of circumstance. We are beginning to record our coverage of The Prisoner during the outbreak of novel coronavirus 19, COVID-19, the coronavirus, whatever.
The Rona.
Whatever you want to call it. And I'm not going to say that that is going to be the lens through which we look at The Prisoner, but that is going to be a constant way that we process seeing this guy who's trapped in one place and trying to escape.
right.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's going on. But that's what you were talking about before. Yeah. So you want to just get into the business of it?
For sure.
Cool.
Context is important. That's why we mentioned stuff like that. Chats is a show we try to be. We bring some levity to television, but we're also here to talk about TV, why we love it and how it affects our lives, how we view it through different lenses. and the different ways that we can criticize and praise different types of TV storytelling. So
yeah, and I will say that our goal also is not to sort of produce a definitive take, but rather to have a conversation that is like very much grounded in our own opinions and our own reactions and relations to whatever we're watching, because the vast majority of things that we watch are things that we're watching for the first time. So we've not seen The Prisoner before. We watched episode one once a few months ago to pilot it, to try it out. And actually the previous episode on this feed is us piloting it, so you can listen to that if you haven't already. But yeah, we're experiencing this for the first time. So whether you have seen The Prisoner before, or you've seen parts of it, or you haven't seen it at all, I think that that'll be useful context for you in listening to our discussions. So let's get into it. This week we watched episode... We're going by the order on how it's streamed on Amazon Prime. This is, I think, the air order. It's not the production order, but I think it's the air order. So I think we're good there. No, like, mismatches or rearrangements. This week we watched episode one, Arrival, and episode two, The Chimes of Big Ben. Episode one, Arrival, was written by George Markstein and David Tomlin. It was directed by Don Chaffee. It originally aired September 29th, 1967. Alan, what happened in Arrival?
Well, Magellan, I'm glad you asked. In this episode, after resigning, a secret agent finds himself trapped in a bizarre prison known only as The Village. I love these one-sentence summaries. Most of the ones I've seen on the wiki are one-sentence summaries. Mm-hmm. Magellan, this is our second time watching Arrival. I'm curious, what did you think about it upon revisiting it?
I didn't watch it super closely the second time because I also listened back to our pilot coverage of it. So I didn't really feel the need to like study it closely. But I think the thing that struck me about both of these episodes on the rewatch was that the show is actually really funny.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and it was funny in the way... So part of my like social isolation, work from home situation that's been going on since everything in the world has affected the U.S. Is I, on breaks from work or sometimes during my work, I have the Game Show Network on, and I also will turn on Buzzer, which is the like old timey game shows. And I was watching some episodes of game shows from like the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And the people who are on Hollywood Squares in like the 80s kind of, there's this sense of humor that we don't really, I think it's just not the taste, the time anymore. This like very fast, but also incredibly dry thing that is happening here in The Prisoner, and that also happens on game shows like that, where constantly the things that number six is saying are like comebacks and digs and jokes, but he doesn't care about being funny, you know?
Right. And there's no pause for laughter or anything either.
Yeah. He's not trying to get a laugh. He's doing it entirely to be defiant. And it's really fun because the stuff that he's saying is genuinely witty. And then the bad guys, ostensibly, also are like, ah, man, you're friggin' funny, dude. I mean, the thing that I called you at the beginning from the second episode is number two in the second episode being like, ho, 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 I got to put that in your file. You are a silly man.
Hmm.
So I think that's what I noticed rewatching this, is just the moments that I found genuinely funny. Like when he's first on the island and he goes to the store and he asks for a map. And the map just says the mountains around it, yeah, on all sides. And then he's like, can I get a bigger map? And the guy gives him a physically larger map that's the same thing.
Like, it borders on like not sitcom humor, but like sketch humor sometimes. So it's
a little
like
bit, that, yeah, right.
That timing and that pacing a little bit feel very, very crafted like that. I love that stuff. I think that is what reels you in, because otherwise this show is very isolating and scary. It's based in a lot of, it has a lot of like horror tropes and thriller tropes. in its antagonists and the ways that they go about their goals. But also, yeah, it's like it acknowledges how absurd this is and its main character does too, without feeling like too self-aware, you know. It's aware that it's on an island that like shouldn't be off of any map or anything, but it's not like this is a wacky TV show. It never touches that territory.
Yeah, it's sort of it's like if one of the Sims became self-aware, you know?
Oh my god, it is. Yeah.
Because you're never this isn't true. Some people do try to kill their Sims, but
oh yeah.
But it let's like usually whatever, the way the game intends for you to play, you're not supposed to be killing your Sims. And
sure, yeah.
The island is not trying to kill number six. Whereas in other thriller shows, it's about like the main character is in imminent danger. And he's not in imminent danger ever.
No, they say they're not going to kill him. They have no reason to kill him. They want him there.
Yeah, and so that I think gives the show its lightness because he knows that they're not going to kill him. He doesn't want to kill himself. They just will have these kind of silly back and forth interactions of, oh, I'm trying to escape again. And they're like, oh, okay. Oh, you can't. You can't get out. Oh, we're just going to, like when he's in the helicopter and he's flying away, he's like, yeah, I did it. And the helicopter just turns around and lightly lands on the ground.
Gently just lands right back where he started. The rover, the big like intimidating iconic like orb that rolls around, just like passes by him, and he's like, ugh, again, here we go, and walks towards camera, and like that's how the episode ends, is this moment of like, ugh, you got me this time.
Yeah. And the fact that the most dangerous thing is this like giant human-sized stress ball
yep.
Again, just speaks to how this show is like, it's not a comedy, but it's like silly in ways that I think are very that work to its favor.
Yeah, and it weaves in and out of that humor with a lot of like heavy symbolism without being heavy-handed. Like there's every single conversation feels like you could relate it back to something either historically or back to some sort of theme. I think some of the main themes we've gained from the show so far, you know, fear of outsiders. This is obviously a show that takes place, I think, around the time that it was made, so 1967, it seems like. Mm-hmm. I think they name-dropped the Iron Curtain at one point. He talks about going back to the UK, which is where he's from originally. Mm-hmm. We see in the intro, which is, again, so iconic and so gorgeous, him driving this, like, amazing yellow, like, mini car, and before he goes back to his place and he's gassed and sent to the village. We see like a United Kingdom that is very of its time, like very 1960s. Mm-hmm. And like between the outfits and all that stuff, it feels like there's also this theme of independence versus control and like submitting to a higher power versus like asserting your dominance over your own life. Self-actualization and like how we can work with others and how we have to like manipulate others sometimes to get what we want. Mm-hmm. It's really, really dense, but in a way that, again, does it feels much more, and I think we talked about this in the pilot chats, but literary more than, like, lore heavy. It doesn't feel like I'm going to read a book about the village, you know?
Right. It's what is nice about it is it's coming from an era of television that is before the need to understand why, you know?
Right, right.
We don't need to understand why the island exists, why it is structured the way it is. We don't really need to understand who number two is or number one is. And so I haven't seen Lost. You just mentioned Lost, right? I'm not making that up.
I did not mention Lost.
Oh, okay. I guess I'm
that up. But for folks at home, I'm a huge fan of Lost. I've watched all of that show. I loved it at the time. And this show definitely inspired Lost in a lot of huge ways. Yeah.
And, you know, with Lost, the discourse when it was on was entirely about like, ooh, what does this mean? Who's this guy? What's going to come next? What's the plot? Whereas with The Prisoner, you can ask those same questions, but it's clear that the show is not really about that. It's about what are the like, the deeper philosophical questions that it makes you ask about yourself and about society that are evoked by the circumstances of the show, instead of the circumstances of the show being the purpose of the show.
Right. And I think so much of the way it works in that landscape of like 1960s TV is you don't expect this guy to get off the island, at least in this at this point in the show. Like, I have no idea if he does at the end. I kind of doubt it from what I've like read a little bit here and there. But
same.
You're watching it and you like I said, you obviously know by the end of this episode he's not going to be getting off or he's going to fall back on. But they've now done it twice where I'm like, is he and I fall for it. It's this like beautiful alchemy that the show can like reel you in and like put you into number six's position of like, yeah, I know I could fit into this situation, but I don't want to, and I know how to get out, and I'm smarter than the system, I can get out. It's like asserting that belief that like I'm better than this. Mm-hmm. And it's and then the show constantly endlessly pushing back and saying, no, you're not. You are working within a framework that we've created for you. Like, you don't have any control here, actually.
Yeah. And it's we talked about in our pilot, number six as a protagonist and what sets him apart from other protagonists. And a main thing that we talked about was that it's implied that so the mystery of the show, if there is one, well, number one, the mystery is like the world, this crazy freaking island and the numbers and what's going on. Oh my God.
Yeah.
This is nuts. But the sort of question that the powers that be are asking number six and that he's refusing to tell them, and we don't know the answer, is he resigned from being a spy. Why did he do that? And presumably, at least he seems to be implying over the course of the first couple episodes that he did it for like moral reasons, that he became disillusioned with his spy work or something like that. That answer doesn't seem to be satisfying to them, so it doesn't seem like that is the truth. So it could be that there's something much more sinister going on, and we don't know. So then what I find unique about number six as a character is that the reason that we're invested in him emotionally and the reason that we sympathize with him is not because we think like he's a good guy, because we don't know anything about him, and he's a complete jerk when he's on the island because everybody is a fake person. So like, you can't judge him by the metrics of functioning in a society because he knows it's a simulation. So the reason that we empathize with him or that we want to cheer for him is simply because of what he says in this iconic line that you quoted in our pilot. And I just want to re-quote again, where he says, I will not make any deals with you. I've resigned. I will not be pushed, filed, stamped, indexed, briefed, debriefed, or numbered. My life is my own. And that's it. That's what we're rooting for, is the concept of individuality.
I'm not a number, I'm a person, is the other really famous line from that pilot.
Yeah.
That gets reiterated in the second episode. Like, he's not getting out of this because he hates it. He thinks it's fine. He could totally live here forever, but he just doesn't like that he didn't choose to come here.
Right. And so what I think the reason that it's so easy to get caught up in like, oh my God, he really has escaped, is because we really want to believe in like free will, and we really want to believe in individuality.
Exactly. Yeah. And the way that the show pushes back on that, I think, is really fascinating, and like how they choose to portray that throughout the series is going to be something to keep an eye out on. Like, are the villagers happy? Because there's moments like when the other man, who we learn later is named Cobb, tries to escape and he is instantly attacked and knocked unconscious by the rover, where everybody looks at him and everybody just kind of like stares, but nobody is like mean. All of the people are just whimsical and seem to be almost like anesthetized by the system. And they're just so used to it that they have no reason to question anything. Mm-hmm. And they're comfortable. And then the people that number six interacts with seem always like they want to push back against it despite what's going on and what is their place in life. And what we learn multiple times is like everybody who thinks like that is being used against him specifically. because as number two says in the second episode, this is a guy who could make putting on his like morning, his evening pajamas an act of rebellion somehow.
Hmm.
He just has that in his DNA. He will not follow systems, which is also why I think he resigned, ultimately. Is something about the group that he was working for as a spy rubbed him the wrong way, and he felt controlled in that environment. And so it's just all about him escaping one form of control to find himself in another one. Related to also, one of the things I like about number six's character that comes across really well in Arrival is just how he's not like what you usually see with characters like this who are in a mysterious place and like a stranger in a strange land. He takes a lot of time to figure out like, why is this happening and who's here and why are you doing this to me? But he's not, he doesn't seem scared. He's just like tired and annoyed. And he's like, come on, like, give me a chance. Like the frustration for him doesn't, he doesn't feel like he's going to break down crying at any point. And that obviously ties back into him being like a 1960s action hero, but also like he's exhausted. He's like sick of this. He's just, he knows he's in a loop and he's struggling to get out of it. And I find that so fascinating and had to contrast that to other characters of his type.
Yeah. It's sort of the vibe that he gives off is like Bill Murray's character in Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Where there are
slightly
times,
less suicidal, but yes.
Well, yeah, way less suicidal.
Entirely less.
I think most of what Bill Murray's character does is suicide.
Yeah.
But it's that same idea of, oh, okay, the rules of society don't apply anymore. Okay, so can I just have what I want then? No, I'm trapped in this. Great.
Okay, I guess I'm good.
I guess I'll just fuck around a little bit. Yeah. Play some chess. Sure, why not?
Might F around and play some chess with a random guy who changes every episode.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's so fascinating how these episodes work in tandem, because we've talked, when we piloted the first one, it's like, the beats of it are, he comes to the island, a bunch of people speak different languages to him, he tries to get a map, he can't get a map, he gets a home, he doesn't like the home, he gets a maid, he doesn't like the maid, he goes to the doctor, he meets Cobb, he sees the group therapy room, which is honestly my favorite image in both of these episodes still. The like bright pink people sitting in a room with like helmets on, the group, they call it, they like specifically say what kind of thing it is. It counteracts obsessional guilt complexes producing neurosis, which is like a lot to dig into just from that brief shot of like, here's a bunch of people sitting in a room talking about this. And it has like almost Kubrickian levels of just brief shots that are jam packed with symbolism that I love so much.
Yeah, definitely.
The gibberish man who we didn't even mention the first time because it's so brief, but there's a shot when he's in the hospital of a man who's just looking at a silver floating orb and like kind of shouting at it in gibberish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, what? This is all intentional, obviously, at least to some sort. Like, it's not just, we're trying to be weird and confuse number six. Like there's like something underlying in this series going on that I'm like finding so, so interesting and wanting to like get into it more.
Yeah.
That was why I was like immediately ready. Like after finishing this first one, I'm like, all right, cool. We get all the themes in this one. We see him try to escape. It doesn't work. We know what he's about. We see the red hat lady. What's next? Like, let's keep going. And even though, like we said, the ending is laid out for us every episode, I'm still fascinated by the steps we take to get there.
Yeah. I am. Something I'm wondering about the other characters on the island. So you talked about, like, first of all, people being complacent, and then also about this, like, all the people in this room where their minds are being messed with, and that guy at the end of the hallway. Something that is sort of disorienting is that it's impossible to know whether this is an island for many different spies who like tried to resign and they have secrets or people like that, or if this is all entirely
for him,
a simulation for him, and everybody's fake.
Right. That's a great question. And I think it's explained more, because in the first one, he's the person who's like, come on, you don't like being here, do you, May? Like, you're not happy here. And she's like, I guess I'm fine. Like, I don't want you to try and pull me out of this. But he's looking for somebody, and he finally finds, like, the woman in the red hat who appears to be his confidant, who's like, I'm going to whisk you away, and I'm going to get you the item you need to get the helicopter to get out of here. Like, it's this weird, it feels like this weird circle of, like, spies lying to other spies sometimes.
Yeah, it seems to be implied in the first episode that the guy who was in the hospital with him, who jumps out the window and dies, that woman was in love with him.
Yep.
And then he, at the end, is, like, able to leave. So it seems to be implied that there are multiple spies on this island who, like, if you cooperate, you can kind of move up the chain, or you can get rewarded. But I'm not sure about it.
Yeah, that's my currently prevailing theory. Especially because, like I said, the second one is him being the Lady in Red to another person. So right now, as we start, it's this, like, very simple balancing act of, like, who do we trust, and who's in charge here? And is the big reveal supposed to be that, like, we're all in that, like, loop of spies, betraying spies to make their way up and to gain their own safety and freedom? And why are we doing that?
Yeah. I think it's more likely that he's the only one.
Is that more exciting? Is that more sad? Like, how do you...
I mean, I think it's best that it's ambiguous.
Yeah. I think that's...
But if I had to guess, I would say that he's the only one.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, so he tries to get on the helicopter, and he doesn't. They turn it right around, and they're like, "All right, well, he didn't make it. Good job, guys." Do you have any stray notes or things that you thought about that you didn't notice on your first viewing?
Another connection that I'm making just now in our talking about this is I'm about to spoil season one of The Good Place.
Yeah, okay, sure. So season one, Good Place spoilers, skip ahead, what, like a minute, 2 minutes?
Yeah, two minutes. Okay. So you find out at the end of season one of The Good Place that almost everybody in The Good Place is actors except for the, like, four main characters. Mm-hmm. And the guy who claimed to be God is actually is a demon.
Right.
So it has that, the show has that vibe. So I'm wondering if The Good Place is, like, drawing on that a little bit. Consciously or subconsciously. I'm just seeing media that's more recent that seems to be maybe in a related, maybe because they watch The Prisoner doing prisoner things, or maybe because they're just ideas that, you know, great minds think alike. I'm seeing those similarities, but the stuff where it's like, oh, the taxi driver drove me around in a circle to where I started, has the vibe of The Good Place, where it's like, this is a heaven that isn't very heavenly.
Exactly. This is, maybe this was what I wanted, or I thought I wanted, but it is definitely not. It is false.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that stuff. I really do. And I'm like, so... I'm like mystified by this. It doesn't feel like a lot of other TV also. That's one of the things to sort of talk about it from a broader television perspective. We don't watch a lot of stuff that is this old, but The Prisoner is one of the most influential shows, like, of all time, period, right? So watching it, you're like, oh yeah, that's totally in that thing. Or that's like, they probably basically made it based off of this. And like that idea came from this. And like The Prisoner... it's like opening up like a sacred text and realizing so much of history and societies from this.
Right. Yeah.
That's what it feels like watching this show. Like we're watching something.
Yeah. It's like when you read a novel that you've heard the title of forever and ever, and then you finally
read it.
What
the novel is.
Yeah. And you're like, whoa, this is pretty cool.
And there's so much value in doing that with, especially like older stuff, because a lot of culture and media is about like keeping up with things and like watching the new thing, but like there's all of this old stuff that's so easy to access. Like we mentioned earlier, we watched this on Amazon Prime Video. It's also on a service called Shout Factory if you're not in the US and you don't have Amazon Prime. So it's like very easy to watch this like really gorgeous, really influential and important show. And I think it's just like worth, that's why we chose it. That's part of why we chose it. It's just, it is good. Like, even separate from how it influenced television, it's just fun to watch and really engaging.
Yeah, definitely.
There was other stuff I had from this first episode. I really do love the "be seeing you" hand motion. I think it's
awesome.
It's fun in the way that like other salutations are, because you can kind of shorten it or make it as long as you want. It's basically an index and thumb finger together in an O, and then you kind of pull it away from your eye. But you can kind of do it like really quickly, like "yep, be seeing you," almost like a tip of the hat. It has a lot of like connotation, and it's very fun that everyone does it to each other. And
yeah,
by the second episode, Six is already doing it to everybody. He's like, "I'm this is a thing I can do too."
And it's unsettling, which is its main function, I think. That it just the first time you see it, you go, "Oh no!"
Exactly.
Oh, I don't like that.
Yeah. Why is that? Like, yeah. The same, but on the same idea. I paid more attention to the cinematography this time, and the cuts in the show are really...
They're weird.
They're super weird. Occasionally, they will kind of jerk away in the middle of a scene from, like, shot to shot, and I truly can't tell if it's just, like, an awkward edit or it's... But it does add to this feeling of, like, unsettlingness.
Yeah, there are a lot of jump cuts in this show. And, I had the same question. Of whether,
like, is this supposed to make me feel more confused? Because sometimes it's just of like Six talking to someone, right? And you're just like, "Oh, now we're on the opposite side of the room." And okay, well, that's weird. All right, sure. I guess that feels weird.
Yeah.
Maybe it's supposed to be like people are always watching from all directions, and you're not safe, and you're not like locked into one spot. Hmm. It could be a lot of things. I really liked that when he gets out of the hospital, the things that they hand him are an ID, a credit card, and health insurance. Like, just a beautiful village, just full of nice people who are like, "Here's all the things you need to exist in life: are the ability to spend money, health insurance, and an ID, like a thing that determines who you are individually."
Mm-hmm.
And then my last thing was just the fashion report on the show is just so good. All the outfits on the show are amazing. Number two in particular, the first number two, because I know number two changes every week. Looks like one of those Instagram model guys who like sell you their shoes from Fashion Nova or whatever. Like, he just had, it's a good fit. Everyone looks good. They all have really good loafers. All the women have these like gorgeous dresses and hats. I think.
Everybody's really styling.
The village itself, I believe, I just looked this up and I'm already forgetting where the island actually is. It's in Europe, obviously, but it's not. It's not France. It's like one of those other island places. And it just has that vibe of like a little bit of Mediterranean, a little bit of like old French. It's intentionally kind of like a multicultural.
Mm-hmm.
North Wales, Port Marion, North Wales. I might be saying that wrong, but that's where the island was. Everyone speaking different languages is really cool too. The shopkeeper speaks Italian. The first woman he meets speaks French. And he asks her, "Why did you speak to me in French?" And she's like, "Oh, French is international." Just made me smile. Like having like this specific language from this specific country is international. You're like, yeah, cool. That's how a lot of people talk about English also. just the themes of individuality coming through really well. But the rest of it was pretty straightforward, this first one.
Yeah. I have a couple notes from the Prisoner Wiki. I don't think there are a lot of other episodes that have stray notes like this, so I don't know if we'll do this every time, but this is what we have for Arrival. So, trivia. The first letters of the name Cobb, the guy who's in the hospital, are the first letters of the title words for the Chimes of Big Ben. C-O-B-B.
Oh, Chimes of Big Ben.
Yeah, I don't know if that's intentional or...
If that's just some huge-brained...
Yeah, that sounds like the huge-brained stuff that I would read when I would buy those like Harry Potter prediction books that would come out.
Oh, boy.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, man. We should find... That would be fun to do like a read of... I mean, I don't know that people are doing prediction books anymore because of the web. But
because of the way the web works, right? But yeah, there was a specific time on the internet when like between Harry Potter books like 5 and 6 and then 6 and 7, where there was a lot of just like theorizing and people mm-hmm. being like, this is objectively what's going to happen, all that stuff. Yeah.
The opening main title sequence is seen in the episode is unique. As the prisoner drives into the car park, he takes a ticket from a dispensing device, then exits the car and pushes through a pair of doors marked way and out, respectively. We see the hearse waiting for him as he pulls out into the street. Then somehow it is in front of him and he passes it. None of this is seen in subsequent episodes. An extended version of the theme tune is used and is not used again. Yeah.
I like the theme tune a lot. The theme tune. It's very catchy.
Me too. Two versions exist of Arrival. A slightly longer version with different theme music and several different scenes, including a different conclusion in which the rover attacks number 6 after he leaves the helicopter, was released on DVD in the UK in 2003. A 2007 DVD release includes an improved quality version, restored from a faded 35mm print, which can also be viewed with a music-only soundtrack. Rumors of a 2-hour version have also persisted. However, no such edit has yet been located.
Oh, snap.
The rover was not identified by this name on screen, except in the later episode, The Schizoid Man.
So wait, now it's just no one even like refers to it. Which
yeah, it's
weird.
Just like a big orb.
That exists, and no one's like send out the orb. It just, and I one of the things I noticed in the second one is like it always kind of spawns in an interesting way. I forget exactly where it comes out of in the first one, but it like rolls over a hill when it lands on Cobb, and then the second one it like comes out of the bottom of the ocean, and I'm like, do they just have a bunch of these like stored, or is it one like the one rover? Like I
great question.
Nothing, no answer is possible there, but it's fun to think about.
Mm-hmm. Let's see then. This next piece of trivia talks about a similar subplot in a later episode, so we won't talk about that. At 17 minutes 15 seconds, the siren of the taxi plays the Twilight Zone theme as a reference to the TV show. The Twilight Zone certainly influenced the creators of The Prisoner for the strange situations the characters were facing.
Huh.
That's cool.
Interesting to think about what somebody was inspired by at the time.
Yeah. I also heard that there was like a riff on Pop Goes the Weasel.
Yes, there's like a chopped and screwed Pop Goes the Weasel.
Yeah, it's like...
My favorite one of those was towards the end of this episode when the guy playing chess with the red woman, the one with the red hat, rather, when he's like saying bye to her or something. He goes like, he starts doing the drunken sailor, and he like starts it, and then the diegetic music picks up exactly on the note that he leaves off on. And it was like this weird moment of like, whoa, that's really well done.
Yeah, that's funny. Cool. Well, that's episode 1 of The Prisoner. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back for episode 2, The Chimes of Big Ben.
Bong. Bong. Welcome back to Prisoner Chats. We're still here. We're talking about The Prisoner. Specifically, we are here to discuss episode 2, The Chimes of Big Ben. This episode was written by Vincent Tilsley, directed by Don Chafee. It originally aired October 6th, 1967. Lots of sixes, huh? Very mysterious, huh, Magellan?
I'm discovering something.
And I'd like you to discover what happened and tell me what happened in The Chimes of Big Ben, please.
I will tell you that what happened was, in this episode, a new number 8 named Nadia arrives in the village, and together she and number 6 plot their escape. Alan, what'd you think of The Chimes of Big Ben?
There was a lot riding on this episode, right? Because I've now watched the first one 2 times.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you guys gotta, like, there's 17 episodes of the show or whatever. I need to know what you're going to do with this. And for the answer to be like,
otherwise I'm not watching anymore. I don't care if I do a podcast about it.
Yeah. I'm just going to phone it in for the rest of the show. Like I already do.
Yeah. I'm going to lean back in my chair and fall asleep like Magellan used to do.
Smoke a big cigar and sleep and eat cheese all night.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was like, okay, what's like, what are you going to do? And for it to be like, we're going to do different types of escape movies or different type of escape plot lines. I'm super on board, man. This is, this was a thrilling episode. It takes a little bit to build because there's like new characters being introduced. We have a new number two, obviously. And we have Nadia, who gets a lot of time back in her backstory. But what I think worked so well, and we kind of talked about it in that first half, was she kind of has his arc from last episode for most of this. And that's scary. What did you think of it?
It's not like the show needs to please us, but I also went into this like, okay, we've committed to it. I hope it's cool. And it's cool. It's better. This episode I liked more than the first one, I think.
I agree.
And part of what I really loved about it is seeing the character of number six get into the village a little bit more and be like, yeah, all right, I'll fuck it up. I'll enter this contest and win. That sounds good.
Yeah, and I'll be good at it, and I'll woodwork like no one's ever woodworked before.
Yeah, I'll talk about how I've made abstract art and I built my own tools. And the guy's like, oh, like the caveman. And then he's like, yeah, look out, I might make fire next. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, the sass between number two and number six in this episode is top tier.
This is a very fun number two, this guy.
Agreed. He's a little bit portly. He's got a big beard. He's a very fun dude. And they rib each other really well. Like the comedy comes through so much better with those two because Six knows that this is like another number two and it's going to change next week. So he's like, well, I'm not going to get too attached. I can just roast this dude like he's in the group chat and he just made a typo.
Yeah, right.
And he just will be gone in a week. So who cares?
Yeah.
This is like in the beginning of the episode, they're talking to each other and he's asking like, whose side are you on? And the guy's like, that would be telling. Which I like the double entendre there. And I just like, yeah, I think this number two is a lot more fun. And watching number six, like, get more comfortable in the village and, like, he knows the loop now is super fun.
Yeah, I am. So let's talk about number two for a second and, yeah, like, what the deal is here. So what does it mean to be a number two?
Well, I think specifically the number two seems to be the person that's managing number six.
Yeah.
And as we learn in this episode, the people of the village highly regard number two as like a pillar of the community. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that means he's a leader is into question because they do follow his orders. Like in the first episode, when he tells everybody to freeze, everybody in the town freezes. And he has access to this whole spy network and all of the surveillance footage and cameras in the entire village. But like, he doesn't seem like a leader or a dictator of any sort. He just kind of is like a mastermind.
But it's sort of like a mastermind, but also there seems to be some element of like, if you're number two and you can't crack number six, then you're gone.
Yeah.
And like, are you dead or something? Who are these guys who get assigned to be number two? Are they former spies who like think like a spy and they sold out to the system? And, because this guy, the number two in this episode, he is cracking jokes with number six, but he also has this urgency about him and like needing to get number six to submit that, I don't know. To me, it feels like there's something that's going to happen to him if he can't accomplish it.
Right. That's why they ask more in this episode, who's number one? He's like, why do you keep asking who number one is? I think that also ties into another theme of the show, which is that maybe it's this Western view, maybe it's something else of superiority and of like monarchy and being like, all right, this has to go higher than you. You can't just be the guy. There has to be like another secret person above you. And there probably is, like you said, then this number two doesn't seem to have, he's not omnipresent and omnipowerful. Like he still is beholden to some sort of force, but yeah, whether or not that's a singular number one or if that's a system and like a government or something, we still don't fully get.
Right.
There's a lot of misdirection. I think like fake answers given in this episode, like him saying that there might not be a number one and Nadia telling number six that like she determined that we're on an island, we're in Lithuania, which is just that there's no way that's true. But also, if it's not true, then what's true? Like, is anything true?
I don't know.
What does truth mean?
I don't know.
It's like the sort of like underlying anxiety of the series is, well, if any information we get, how do we prove it? Because like, let's say we're in Lithuania. Okay, what does it do for us? Like, he says, okay, that means if we take a boat and we go west, we're going to end up in this country. And if we go over here, we're going to end up in this country. So we have to go that direction. But they don't, none of it works. They don't go anywhere. So they could just not even be there. That could be another lie. And why would she tell him that if it was true anyways?
Right. And also she, yeah, she's part of the system of people who are lying to him.
But even if she is, she could still tell him that and it wouldn't change anything. Like, knowing that you're in Lithuania is like, okay, like, great, I'm in Lithuania, bummer. Okay.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It's just like information to make him feel powerful, which I think is the brilliance of Nadia's performance in the universe. Like, the character of Nadia performing, not even just the actress performing as her, but it's all about making number six feel like you're outsmarting the system. You're way better than everybody here. You figured it out. Yeah, I need help, and I need you to
and
guide
also,
me.
And also, like, appeal to his hero complex, because he doesn't really try to be a good guy. But again, if the reason that he left the spy life is because he thought that being a spy was morally bad, there seems to be some aspect to him, you know, that he, like, wants to protect the woman who needs to be protected, and he wants to do the right thing, and that seems to be how they can catch him.
I think so much of the set too, and like the shot design of the show is like relating back to all those themes of control, because there's a scene later where she's like, I'm really nervous about this place and I don't belong here. Like, she's doing what Six did in the first episode. And he later sees her on the beach and he's like sitting on an array, like a cliff above her, thinking he's watching her. But really, he's the one being watched in this scene. She's just on the beach hanging out. And number two is the one who comes and sits next to him. And he's like, hey, what's up? You know, I'm a prisoner too. He's like, wait, really? And he's like, yeah, I mean, I don't have the ability to leave here either, but I don't want to because I like it here. But doesn't that mean that we're both prisoners? Why are we fighting? Isn't it great here? It's just this really like deep sense that no matter what number six does, he is being manipulated on like several levels higher than he thinks he is.
Right.
They also make a line. They have a line in that part that's like, he's like, what do you want, Six? And he says, oh, I want to be the first man on the moon. And then like me realizing, doing some brief Googling, that the show takes place in, or came out in 1967 and the moon landing was in 69. And I was like, whoa, they lived in a pre-moon landing society. That's cool.
Yeah, that's true.
That's like
stuff.
A funny joke at the time.
Yeah, we really thought we were going to keep doing that, huh?
Yeah, we were like, let's now that the moon, what's next? And what's next is social isolation.
Just go home. Yeah.
Let's go home.
Even further towards our couch.
Wash your hands real good. Play Animal Crossing.
Yeah, that's the
first the moon, next my village in the video game.
Yeah.
That was a weird moment. And that one of the themes that showed up in this episode that I kind of was like retroactively thinking about in the first one is that this is a show in some ways about the Cold War and like the fear
of, for sure.
Of Europe and like the way that the United States and of London and all that, how everyone's afraid of everyone and who's lying and who has the power and who's gonna pull the trigger first, like all that stuff is here.
Yeah.
Nadia reveals to number six that she's from Estonia, and he's like, "You're from Russia, right?" She's like, "No, I'm actually Estonian." He's like, "So you're Russian, right?"
<She's> yeah, like, it's all Russia.
We don't think so.
Yeah.
It's a different country, dude.
Yeah. I think the Cold War influence on this show really comes down to like both how important information and the truth is, and also how impossible it is to trust anybody at all.
Exactly.
Like pretty much every character's motivation in some way relates to they want to know the truth. That's what everybody wants from number six. They want to know the information about like, okay, why did you resign? And he wants to know, okay, what's going on here? and they can't trust that he'll give them a straight answer. He can't trust that anyone is going to give him a straight answer. And so it's like, how do any of these characters achieve their objective of knowing stuff when you have no way of knowing how to know stuff?
Or what if, like, if you find information, is it real? Like the Lithuania thing where it's like, finally, I got this key piece of info, and it's like, it's probably fake. It's probably everything is
fake. Yeah, and like you said, there might be some truths or some information that even if you knew them, you'd be like, okay, I guess that's not useful, yeah, at all.
There's so much like real life anxiety in that too. I think I was a fan at the time that it was airing of The Americans, the TV show about Russian spies living in America and like disguising themselves as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that show attempts to capture this like this exact same Cold War fear, but somewhat less successfully, because instead of like trying to use metaphor or trying to be subtle about it, it's just like the iconography of like, greetings, comrade. I have to take my daughter to soccer practice. Like, just the corniness of it being the 80s and everyone's afraid of that stuff. And that's like the, you know, the back end of the Cold War. So it's a different historical context, but I digress.
Yeah, it seems this show seems to capture the just underlying tension of trying to live a normal life in a Cold War society to a certain extent. Like, obviously he's a spy and he's got a spy past and all that, but he's also living in this like quasi-utopian suburban community where people are just sort of willfully closing out or shutting out the world around them and living in this fantasy land of constant denial, but also constant paranoia. And so I think to a certain extent, this show is satirizing post-World War II suburban society. And maybe that's not as true of, because I don't know the historical context of Great Britain during that time, so maybe that actually wasn't what life was like in Britain during that period of time, but at least from an American standpoint, contextually, that was that certainly would have been influencing like American products or shows at the time that were confronting similar themes.
Yeah, and it makes me want to read so much more about the time period to like get more context for this. I believe there is actually a documentary about The Prisoner that I'm interested in checking out.
Oh, really?
But I'm pretty sure I saw that somewhere.
We should add that to our thing.
Yeah, we'll try to talk about that in the interim, or at least at some point in this discussion or in this podcast. But there's so much historical context, especially like with this episode and with Nadia talking about how she's from Estonia and she has the secret agent friend. And initially her first escape attempt is she tries to swim away, and that obviously goes terribly because the rover appears out of the water, knocks her out, and she's taken to an interrogation room. And I think this is one of the scariest scenes in the episode, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, maybe more so actually, when you know that it's all fake, because what's happening is number two, number six are behind glass, and Nadia is inside of a room where a camera is like spinning around her and relentlessly interrogating her, asking her, why did you go swimming? What was your problem? What was your problem? Why did you leave? Why were you trying to leave? And just repeating. And number two remarks to six that like she's slowly but surely picking up on the fact that there is electricity going through the floor every like 6 seconds, and she can totally get across the room and get out in 6 seconds, but it's a matter of her being confident enough to do it. So it's not like they're hiding it. It's just like we are testing if she wants to escape or not. Because she could, but it's just like, are you ready to like take that risk?
Mm-hmm.
And the sad thing is she finally tries to do it, but she gives up at the very last moment and like clings to the ground and is like, let me die. Just kill me. Please let me die. Because she was never going to go for it. Which is very sad. And again, just like is ultimately an attempt to whittle down number six's like resolve, unsuccessfully, because he's a cool dude and he makes a deal with number two, basically saying, I will have her work with me and be with me, and I in return I will do woodworking for your dumb craft Crafts Festival. They do some sneaky plan discussing in the woods while he gathers wood. The woods with wood in them. Really just making it feel like he's the woman in red and she's six from last week. Like, all of the, like, I have the secret info that you need. We're going to build a boat. That ends up being his art exhibit. And they have, like, a nighttime sexy conversation where she does reveal to him that the island is probably in Lithuania, but she's probably lying. And her thing, this is, like, again, such a brilliant manipulation, is she goes, all I ever wanted was to go to London and hear the chimes of Big Ben. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it makes number six feel like a hero. He's like, okay, I'm going to take you. That's going to be your thing. And then that'll be your life well lived. And I can bring that to you because I'm good. And I have a good plan. She calls him Big Ben, and then they go to bed. And then at the exhibition, we get some really weird stuff where everyone's really impressed by his boat exhibit. It just seems weird at the time that they're like, wow, nice boat framework you got going on.
I love the moment in the contest where he wins, and then he's like, come on, but I'm going to buy number 38's art, huh?
Put it, like, wow.
Put it up in my house. And everyone's like, yeah. And he's like, ha, 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 this is a fucking joke.
This is all fake.
She's great, right, everybody?
You just got to love her. She's a nice old lady.
Yeah.
Her painting, by the way, because when people see his boat, they're like, really nice boat, dude. Where's number two on it? He's like, what? We pan around and we realize that everybody else's art has number two incorporated into it somehow. Like, there's this obsession with him or something. So he wins it. He gets the painting. He takes them both home. The plan is to use the painting as a sail and to use the boat as a boat, and that they're going to escape by that. As they're leaving, I was a little bit confused what was going on, because there's a man with a sniper rifle on a nearby beach, and then the rover is also coming for them, and then the rover gets sniped. And I was like, wait, I'm confused. And in hindsight, this all makes a lot more sense. Of course, that's like the whole gimmick of the show. But the man reveals himself to be, I believe, Polish. And he's like, I'm here. I'm a rebel, and I'm here to save you. I killed the rover for you. Thanks, mister. Number six asks him to take a letter to London, basically in code that says that he's okay and he quit for a reason. He puts them in crates. This is very scary. I don't have claustrophobia, Magellan, but I definitely see people get locked in crates and go across the ocean, and I'm like, I want to die.
Oh man, yeah. And they're like nuzzling up against the little wall.
It's like a tender moment.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just so funny when you think about, like, is it the Lost thing? Did they just loop around the island and come back?
Yeah, pretty much. That's.
And he's like, wow, my whirlwind tour across the Europe. Like, this is going to be 12 hours. And then I promise you, we'll get to Big Ben. She's like, how long until Big Ben?
It's just like taking a local taxi.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. It doesn't go anywhere except local. They are finally released from the crates in a place that number six believes to be London. But we, the viewer, are starting to be suspicious because we know what show we're watching. Mm-hmm. And
it can't be this easy. Come on.
It can't be this easy. But there's still a part of me that's like, maybe something. I shouldn't fall for this. I know I'm being a sap, but like, what if? The reason that six exchanged watches with the Polish man was because Poland would be an hour behind on ahead, I guess, on the watch. Mm-hmm. And he thought it was weird that the bell of they hear the chimes of Big Ben. And he's like, there you go, Nadia, you got to hear. And she's like, wow. Anyways, bye. I have to go for mysterious reasons that we're not telling you. She leaves. He realizes that the watch is not on sync. He's talking to this guy who's supposed to be like his commanding officer. Mm-hmm. And this is the moment where I was like, oh, it's all cracking. Where I texted you and I was like, there's like 3 minutes left in the episode and it hasn't cracked yet.
Mm-hmm. How are they going to do this, right?
Yeah, what's the play? And the play is that the guy is like, all right, Six, I'm glad you got back. But this whole island thing, this village thing sounds a little bit kooky. You might, why'd you do that? Are you betraying our country? Like, you went across the pond because you went to the Soviets and you probably defected, right?
Yeah, that was actually the moment that convinced me maybe it's real and maybe he did escape.
Did escape, but it's going to go badly. Yeah.
Yeah, like they're just not going to believe him and they're going to lock him up or something. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, that would be kind of bold, but also this is fake, right? And then it was fake because the chimes of Big Ben, it was just a radio in the closet.
Not only the chimes, but like all of the ambient city sounds
and stuff. Yeah, they sent an intern out with a handheld mic, and we're like, okay, we need about an hour of B-roll here.
Yeah, just give me like people yelling and like car sounds, and then to give me like an 8 o'clock Big Ben horn, bell, and yeah. That's perfect. He realizes that the guy. I like that there isn't any violent moment here where he's like, he doesn't punch the guy in the face. He's like, you're lying. He just pulls the recorder out, stops the recording, opens a door. Hey guys, we're still in the village. We never left. Yeah. It's so bleak.
Yeah.
It's like. And he just walks out, and once again, we follow this like brilliant loop of this show. He looks out, and he's like, ah. And then the recording comes on, and she's like, the next competition is going to be starting next week, everybody. This time, Seascapes. And I was like, oh, my God. Because he tried to escape by sea, you guys.
That's so good.
So good.
I love all the little moments that foreshadow the when he finds out that the whole Big Ben thing is fake. It gives this feeling of the human fallibility of his captors, where they kind of can't help but brag about their whole scheme when they're doing it. So, like, the fact that Nadia calls him Big Ben, it's, like, clearly she's doing that to subliminally remind him of, like, oh, Big Ben is what you associate with London, so when you hear it, you'll think that you're home. But also, it makes him, like, hyper-aware of the noise.
The sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when he and number two are first viewing Nadia waking up in her room, and number two's like, yeah, it's an exact replica, we can do that.
Oh my God, that's a good catch, dude.
He like basically gives away the fact that they can make exact replicas. And then when they're watching Nadia in the room where she's being questioned, and it's like, oh, the floor is electric, and you know, every 3 seconds it electrifies. Let's see if she can figure it out. He again sort of puts into number six's mind, like, yeah, every one of our things has a flaw, and if you just like think about it hard enough, you can figure it out.
You could, like, yeah, giving the idea that like we're not perfect, you could totally break it if you really wanted to.
Yeah, and so it.
Good catches, dude. That's really sharp.
Thank you. Thank you. So the bad guys actually are not, they're not like geniuses, you know, because they're leaving holes in their scheme.
Yeah.
But also they don't need to be geniuses because they're all powerful in this world, and they just have to catch him once, you know, if they can just get him one time, and they almost got him. Ooh. If they can just get him literally one time, that's all that they need.
They have such an easy time that they can just kind of manipulate him like putty.
Yeah.
Ultimately. And I try to think about like what is it about this formula that I find so interesting and fun? Because it's kind of inherently formulaic. Like this is a show where he's going to try to escape every week and he's going to fail every week. That's the nature of it. But on the way there, the different machinations and steps to get there are so different and like feel like they're still building upon everything. Like it doesn't, the sort of like comparison I might have made on the pilot chats is sort of is like a Gilligan's Island, where it just feels like there's no character development because we can't actually have them get off the island. But he's totally he has awareness of what happened in the first episode. Like he didn't forget that stuff. And I think that's tricky.
This is a narrative, it seems like.
Yes, even though like he is living in a loop, he knows, he learned from the last one.
Yeah.
And is developing. So I'm wondering like how they keep up that balancing act.
Yeah, I guess what I really enjoy about this, about the formula, is there's something that I find always inherently exciting and compelling about a story where the villain says, okay, I'm not going to make you do XYZ. I'm not going to try to kill you. I'm just going to put you into situations until you decide that you want to do what I want you to do.
Exactly.
And so I love number two in this episode where the other guy is like, oh, we'll break him. And then number two's like, one piece at a time, and then we'll have like a shattered man. That's not what I want. I want him fully body, mind, soul, spirit to decide to tell us the information. And you can see in that moment where he's about to confess, like he does want to explain to someone why he did what he did. He does want to talk about it. He just doesn't want to tell them because they're like demanding it from him.
Right.
And then the line where he says, don't worry, number six, you'll be cured. I'll see to it. No more nightmares. If you have so much as a bad dream, you will come whimpering to tell it to me.
Oh.
But then six leaves and he's like, whimpering. yeah. So I love that. And then I love, you said that line about his putting on his dressing gown as an act of defiance.
Yeah.
And then that whole the sugar in the tea exchange.
Oh my God. Yep.
Where that, I think if I were to show anyone a scene of like, okay, here's the vibe of the like protagonist antagonist relationship in The Prisoner. It would be that scene because, number two says, okay, how much sugar do you take in your tea? And number six is like, it's in the file. Mm-hmm. You can look there. And then number two gets mad at him. Because it's like, you're just, I know it's there, but if you told me, then I would have control over you, and you would have told me. Then he looks in the file, it's like, oh, you don't take sugar. And then that moment where he drops three sugar cubes in the tea, and you're like, yes. it's the biggest middle finger in TV that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think so.
It's so good. And that's another example. This show's just funny.
Like, it's super that's funny.
Really
yeah.
funny.
Like rebellion can be charming, you know. Rebellion can be like funny and and lovable almost.
The other thing that I like about the formula here is it is formulaic in the sense that there is like a that the main character has a want and he's always going to pursue that want. And the forces that are arrayed against him are always going to stop him from getting that. But also it's a show where like they use a big old white bouncy ball to chase people down. So you know they're going to do some wild stuff.
Oh yeah.
You know that even the formula is going to be so, so wacky.
Right.
Yeah.
I adore it, honestly. Yeah. I think this episode solidified that, like, I'm so in. Like, the first episode is great and surprising on your first watch, but this is, like, they can do it. They can totally maintain this.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm curious to keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any stray notes about this episode, man?
I really liked the way it sounded when he played the Big Ben chimes backwards. It was like...
It's very cool.
Let's see. I was searching for the documentary and I still haven't gotten a conclusive answer on what it's called. I found some 1.5 hour YouTube videos that we can sort through and figure out if I found it or not. Mm-hmm. But I found this article on dangerousminds.net, called 6 into 1 Seldom Seen Doc on Patrick McGoohan's Cult TV Classic, The Prisoner. So maybe that's what it's called, 6 into 1, but I'm not sure. And I found this little quote in this article that I think you'll enjoy. But the whole article's interesting. There's some spoilers in here, though, so don't read it.
Okay.
But this speaks to something we were discussing earlier. The Prisoner was not just a Cold War series about individual freedom in the face of totalitarianism, but the freedom of each individual to choose one's own path and take responsibility for their own actions in a materialist society. McGoohan was against the materialist capitalist world of The Village, and when The Prisoner ended in 1968, he aligned himself with the rioting students in Paris. He hoped his series might inspire a revolution, a point he discussed in an interview as to why the French were so obsessed with his series. Quote, "There comes a time when revolt is necessary." And then he says something about the last episode. Anyway, then he spoils part of the last episode, so don't read that. But this is that Marxism that we crave, I think. I hope.
I think so.
Maybe it's a libertarianism.
To say? Like, is it a hands-off system or is it a each man for himself system? Right.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating. That's so the creators were thinking about that. And again, in 1967, you didn't have to go that hard, but you chose to. And I really respect the hustle there, guys. Like, that's great. Really hope that the show continues to be this good, and I figure it will. But I'm just so I'm like excited by it.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, is that spoiler really good, by the way, Magellan? It sounds like it was. Was it really like exciting? Was it cool?
Yeah, don't look it up. But
I won't look it up.
The show does cool stuff.
Okay, I believe you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Do you want to take it to the close then, sir?
I would love to. You want to give them all the links that they need to know? Oh, before we do that, Alan, will you tell us what we're watching next week on Prisoner Chats?
I certainly will. Next week on next week on Prisoner Chats, we are watching episodes 3 and 4. Episode 3 is called A, B, and C. In A, B, and C, number 2 believes that number 6 resigned because he was going to sell out. Using dream manipulation, number 2 tries to determine which one of 3 possible candidates number 6 was dealing with. And episode 4, Free for All, one sentence, but an incredibly powerful summary.
Okay.
Number 6 runs for the office of number 2.
Oh, yes. That
into it.
Is good.
Into it.
That is good.
I'm so excited.
That is good.
I'm locked the heck in.
That sounds like it might be my favorite episode already.
Already, right?
Yeah.
Well, Magellan, now I'll take it to the real close. We'll take it to the plug zone. If you, dear listener, would like to contact us with questions, comments, concerns about The Prisoner or any other chat season or chats-related questions, our email address is chatspod@gmail.com. That's chatspod@gmail.com. We're also on Twitter @ChatsPod, where you can get updates about the show, and we'll be interacting with listeners over there a lot. You can rate us on Apple Podcasts if you're discovering the show for the first time, or if you've always listened and forgotten to review us, give us a review over there. It helps us, gets us on that algorithm game. And if you want to hear more of our voices every week and also support us financially, you can do so by heading over to patreon.com/chatspod, where we have monthly content that is voted for by the patrons. At just $3 a month, you get access to all of it. We have different payment tiers, but $3 is the, like, you want all the content tier. And we have a lot of fun interactions over there, a lot of fun stuff. We do chats nights where we kind of just hang out and talk about whatever people want us to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
We've got commentary chats where we watch and talk over movies, good and bad. And we have pilot chats where we discover pilots of TV shows and decide whether or not they'll make for a good chat season. And that's how we landed on The Prisoner, actually. So a lot of stuff if you like us and like hearing us and want to like know more about what we do beyond just talking about communism and free will. Now, Magellan, we're a little unique here at Chats Studios. I feel like we do all of our usual plugs, like the show, Twitter, and all that stuff. And we have personal things to plug, but generally we don't like to be the kind of people that are like, follow me on Twitter, because like, whatever. If you find my Twitter, it's great. I'm glad you found it. But that's not my like content that I want the listener to be checking out. Instead, I want them to take a little snack with them every week. And so we call these chatsums, where we just recommend a thing, a piece of media, an activity, a thought experiment, anything. And we recommend one of those a week, each of us. And I would want to know what your chatsum for this week is, John.
I would love to tell you what my chatsum is. My chatsum is a book that I've been chipping away at piece by piece as of late. This is a book that we read an article from the author of it for a professional development at my school a few weeks ago. We were doing like a race and equity, diversity and inclusion type of PD. And we read all of the white members of staff were asked to read an article by the author of White Fragility. So that's the book that I'm recommending. Whether you are a white person or if you are someone who wants to understand white people and how they interact with race and why it is that when conversations of race come up, white people get like all all sorts of, you know, it is a really useful book for that. And it's especially helpful, I think, if you're someone like me who is a white person who has like been in spaces where I've been asked to think about race a lot. And so now I sort of think like, oh yeah, I get it. But as such have fallen into like not critically thinking about my race very much, which is a problem because it's something that white people need to constantly be doing since the way that we grow up is we grow up having no racial consciousness whatsoever of our own whiteness as like a thing as opposed to whiteness as the default. Exactly. So yeah, I highly encourage everybody to read that book. And it's the kind of book that I think, you know, you can read it a couple pages at a time, like read a couple pages a day and sit on it and think about like, oh, that makes me think of this and that. And it'll be pretty useful to you if you do that. What about you?
And that's White Privilege by Robin DiAngelo. By Robin DiAngelo.
Yeah. Because it sort of is about like, you know, when white people are accused of racism and they're like, well, I'm not a racist. What? I don't see color, like things like that.
I have a black friend.
Right. All, and eventually, I haven't gotten to this part of the book, but it, towards the end of the book, they list out like, here are all the things that white people do. There's like, here are the like 20 things white people do.
Yeah, that's awesome. Fantastic. That sounds like a good read. If you're inside and you finished White Fragility, and you want something else to do with your time while you're cooped up right now, I recommend, if you have a Nintendo Switch, all the new hot game that everyone's playing. It's Animal Crossing New Horizon. Basically, it's a game where you play as a villager who moves to a town and is it's like an island that you are tasked with building out. So you build your own house. You go from a tent to a house. You get your neighbors. You help them build. It's about building and creating and sharing. And it's a creative game that is relaxing on a level that a lot of games aren't, because it asks you not only of your like creativity and your like ability to like think about like what looks good with what, but it also asks you to be fucking patient because it's a game that works on a real-time clock. And if you haven't played an Animal Crossing game before, the way it works is like you'll do something, and you know, if you build like a building or you assign someone to build part of your village, that's not gonna be done for a couple days. And you just have to deal with that. And I'm always here for games that ask you to be patient, because I think we just have so much media that like asks, it doesn't ask that of us and wants us to just like consume. And, you know, one of the reasons we started Chats is because we wanted to counter this idea of like binging as the superior way of watching shows. And Animal Crossing is like the video game equivalent of that, of like, just slow down. Just, you can play for like an hour a night. Do all your stuff, collect your things, and build your stuff, and then you just call it, and the game plays itself for a little while. And you can, like, hang out with your friends and make cute outfits, and there's all the animals, and it's cute. And if you have a Nintendo Switch, what are you doing? Just play Animal Crossing. It's
wonderful. You gotta. This is my first Switch game. Nope. It's my God. It's my It's my first Animal Crossing game, and I love it.
It's delightful. Magellan and I played yesterday from when we were recording this, and it started as like, okay, here's the one thing I want to do today. And I just want to like build this thing. And then you're like, oh wait, there's bugs over there. Ooh, I got to go catch that. Ooh, I got to give it to that guy. I got to build this thing. Oh, where do I get materials for this? Ooh, I got to go to this island. And then like 3 hours just vanish. And you're like, you can really lose yourself in it for a little while.
Yeah.
And I think that's so useful in this time that we're in. to just escape for a little bit to a fun island. Ah, well, folks, that's all we got. Thank you, as always, to Magellan for being the rock to my hard place. Thank you to you, dear listener, for listening to this episode of Prisoner Chats. Be seeing you.